I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, it's another edition of the Midday Health Watch, our monthly conversation with Baltimore City's Health Commissioner, Dr. Lena Nguyen. We'll be talking about a new interim report from the President's Commission on Combating Drug Addiction and the Opioid Crisis that calls on the White House to declare a national emergency, as more Americans are now dying from fatal drug overdoses than from car crashes and gun violence. What will a federal plan mean for Baltimore's campaign to curb our own opioid crisis? We'll also be looking at the city's efforts to help low-income seniors find and prepare nutritious food and how a new plan to train doulas could help keep Baltimore's infant mortality rate on its downward trend. Dr. Lena Nguyen is in the house. The Midday Health Watch starts right after the news. And good afternoon on this rainy Monday. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday for the Midday Health Watch. According to the latest estimate from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 142 Americans die every day from a drug overdose. That's more than 50,000 people every year. The majority of these deaths, now surging in more than 30 states, are caused by powerful opioid drugs like heroin and fentanyl, and widely used prescription painkillers like oxycodone and Percocet. Maryland is most certainly in the thick of this epidemic. The number of drug and alcohol-related deaths in our state climbed 37% in the first 3 months of this year, with the biggest increase related to people taking opioids that are laced with the potent additive fentanyl. During the first 3 months of this year, the state reported 550 overdose deaths, including 372 caused by fentanyl-laced heroin. That's nearly triple the number of drug overdose deaths from just 5 years earlier. And while fatalities are climbing in a dozen Maryland counties, Baltimore has the unwelcome distinction of leading the state in drug-related deaths. 176 people died from January through March. That's 60 more than died of overdoses during the same period last year. President Trump established a Commission on Combating Drug Addiction and the Opioid Crisis. It's a five-member group chaired by New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. It issued an interim report last week. Its recommendations got mixed but generally favorable reactions from health officials and addiction experts across the country, including Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Nguyen. Dr. Nguyen joins us this afternoon, as she does every month for the Midday Health Watch. It's good to see you, as always.
Good to see you. I'm glad to be here today, Tom.
And you are welcome to join our conversation with Dr. Lena Nguyen. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, and to join us on Twitter, you can find us at Midday Tom Hall. So before we talk about the opioid crisis a bit and several other topics that we have teed up today, how are you feeling? You are 8.5 months pregnant.
I am.
And we've been following your pregnancy with great interest, low these many months. But you're close to the edge here, huh?
I am. This is baby number one. Mm-hmm. And so I don't quite know what to expect from here. I have a lot of ideas medically for what I can expect, but emotionally, personally, it's an exciting time, mm-hmm. and I'm glad to still be on your show.
Yeah, well, and you were here just a couple of weeks ago, but decided to have you back sooner rather than later, given the fact that you're going to be giving birth to a baby, pretty soon. Did you deliver a lot of babies in your training as a physician?
I did, because I trained in emergency medicine. Mm-hmm. This is something that we learn how to do, but also in emergency medicine, we see all the things that go wrong in a pregnancy. And so the things that go right, or the everyday symptoms that people feel, these are things that I never really, really learn about.
Yeah,
and so it's been an exciting time to go through it myself.
Indeed. Well, we wish you and your baby and your husband all the best. And by the way, I have never delivered a baby. I did audition once for a soap opera to play a doctor.
I haven't done that. So
I had a great monologue. I can't tell until we order more tests. How was that? That's pretty good, right? Pretty convincing.
I'm convinced.
But since you've done it, you could just tell me, you just talk me through it. We can have the little baby, get back to our callers right here on Midday. So I do want to talk about a serious issue, and that is this commission that mm-hmm. the president put together, five people headed by Chris Christie from New Jersey, the governor. to talk about a federal response to the opioid crisis, which really is a national epidemic and has been recognized as such. And their first and foremost recommendation to the president is that he, President Trump, should declare a national emergency. In logistical, practical terms, what does that mean? Were the president to call this a national emergency, does that mean anything more than just symbolic rhetoric, or does it put into play certain things that wouldn't be put into play otherwise?
Well, first of all, there were a lot of us in the public health community who didn't fully understand why there needed to be another commission to study opioids. There was a lot done under the previous administration. There were many recommendations put forth in the previous Surgeon General's report by the Office of National Drug Control Policy as well. And a lot of us questioned why there needed to be more studies done when we actually know what works and when we simply need the resources to get there. And frankly, I was concerned about what would come out in this report, considering some of the stigmatizing and untrue things that have been said, including by members of this administration. When we heard Secretary Tom Price talk about how medication-assisted treatment is, quote, substituting one drug with another, and other things that just aren't true. And so I think a lot of us were skeptical about what would be in this report. The call for a national state of emergency is a welcome one, because I can't even imagine if there were this many people dying from any other disease, any other infectious disease or natural disaster, if there were 142 people a day dying from Ebola, there would be no question that we would be all hands on deck, putting all of our resources on the table, that there would absolutely be a national declaration of emergency. That said, I don't know what that declaration would mean. The commission implied that by declaring a national state of emergency, that would help to mobilize federal agencies faster in pushing through regulations, in helping with additional standards that might assist in this process. All those are good, but I would also want to know what exactly are the resources that would be committed by the president should this declaration come through, because the last thing that we need is more rhetoric, especially at a time when we know unequivocally what actually works. We just need the dedication to get there.
Because in addition to this commission and the rhetoric from Secretary Price, who, by the way, is a physician, we have rhetoric from the president and Attorney General Sessions about the need to build a wall and stop the drugs from coming in and do it as a legal matter. And they say that this is one of the keystones of their policy to fight the opioid epidemic. And of course, medically, and you and I have talked about this here on Midday half a dozen times about, that's just not a medical solution, number one. And it's not the solution it's not the way to the quickest efficacy in terms of helping the people who are currently addicted.
This is a supply and demand issue. We have to decrease the supply of drugs, and there is a law enforcement component that's important. In addition, the decreasing supply also means helping to better educate doctors and prescribers to be more careful about prescribing opioids. That's on the supply side. But we have to devote equivalent, if not more, resources on the demand side, because otherwise we're going to continue to have millions of people who have an untreated addiction, and that's going to further fuel the supply of drugs. And actually, the commission report itself is very much evidence-based. They talked about things like medication-assisted treatment and following best practices. That's excellent. I would hope that they would go, and we issued in the health department, we issued a statement with five additional things that we hope that they would cover, including efforts to protect and expand health insurance coverage, because we can talk about reducing this epidemic and fighting this epidemic all we want, but if people cannot get access to health care in order to treat their disease of addiction, then we're not making a dent at the end of the day. And in fact, we're potentially driving more demand and therefore more supply of drugs.
142 people a day. Mm-hmm. That's like having a September 11th crisis every 3 weeks. But you're not seeing, are you, any change in the trajectory of this. I mean, we're up now 37% from the first 3 months of 2016. Is there any indication that this thing is peaking or will peak at some point in the near future?
I wish I could be more optimistic about this, but I don't think that we have seen the peak of this epidemic yet. And the reason is that, first of all, because of fentanyl, that fentanyl, which is this incredibly strong opioid, many times stronger than heroin, many times stronger than morphine and other types of prescription opioids, is being mixed in with everything. It's being mixed in with heroin. It's being mixed in with cocaine. It's all over our city and all over the country. Our numbers from around the country, and I have the same experience speaking to my counterparts who are the commissioners of health in big cities across the country, we're not seeing a drop in any way. In fact, we're seeing the number of overdoses skyrocket because of fentanyl. Last week, I met with our outreach workers who do incredible work every day on our needle exchange vans. And they're talking about how many of the clients that they've known over the years are dying because of fentanyl. That's why the supply issue is important for us to address. There is a law enforcement component. I mean, when this very dangerous drug is being mixed in with heroin, it's being trafficked in from other countries, we do have to stop that side of it. And until we can figure out how to stop that supply and get people into treatment, because many of the people dying are people who are actually looking for treatment, but they can't get it. And that's why they continue to use drugs. And now they're overdosing on fentanyl as well. So it really requires this comprehensive approach, and we need far more funding to get us there.
And the funding, you're assuming, is going to have to come from the federal government, not from the state, not from the city. For example, one of the great impacts of less funding is the availability and accessibility of naloxone, mm-hmm. which is a drug you did something that was really kind of unprecedented around the country, and it's a model that others are looking to. You essentially prescribe naloxone to anybody in the city of Baltimore who then can have it available to him or her and use it when a person is in an overdose crisis. But now we're – and your estimate is, I think, about 1,000 people have been saved because of a naloxone
over 1,100 now, yeah. in the last 2 years. So 1,100, which is quite incredible.
Yeah, so those are people who would have died.
That's right.
Were they not administered naloxone or something like it?
By lay people. That's not even counting the number of people saved by paramedics, EMTs, and police officers. Mm-hmm. This is just lay people.
Just lay people. That's 1,100
right.
people.
That's
yeah.
right.
So now you're rationing naloxone mm-hmm. because, number one, the price of the drug has gone up. The drug makers are perhaps being exploitative about that. And number two, the funding has gone down. So where does that stand?
We were the last time that we talked, I believe that I had said between now and July of 2018, we have less than 5,000 units of naloxone, which means that we have to stretch out 5,000 units over 12 months. And we are literally literally having to ration. I mean, that is the definition of rationing, that we have to figure out who is most at risk and who we give this to. We were able to get some funding from our state partners through the governor's declaration of state of emergency, and we're grateful for those funds because it'll allow us to replenish our supplies. Still, though, we are far short. And that's
something. But you'll only be able to replenish up to 5,000 doses?
We had 5,000 units to start with. Now, because of the additional funding from our state, we'll be able to have at least 10,000 more units for the health department mm-hmm. and for our outreach partners, which is fantastic. And we absolutely will make the best use of those. I mean, we can give out 10,000 units in 2 weeks if we needed to. That's how much demand there is. This is, though, not only a solution for the city and state governments. We can do all that we can on the city and state level. Ultimately, we would need to turn to the federal government for aggressive negotiations with these pharmaceutical companies so that we're able to get naloxone at a much cheaper price. Again, this is a state of emergency. If this were Ebola and we only had a certain number of antidotes for that illness, we would absolutely turn to the federal government for negotiations. Same thing when it comes to treatment. We in the city have long made do with very little, with very limited resources, but we're going to continue to be very limited in what we can do unless we start having, unless we have health insurance reform and unless we are able to protect Medicaid and all these other factors that help to get us treatment.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is the Baltimore City Health Commissioner. She joins us today for another edition of the Midday Health Watch. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We invite you to join our little talk here about opioids and other issues affecting public health. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Has the opioid epidemic touched your life? Do you think that the leaders here in Baltimore, in Annapolis, and in Washington are doing the right things to confront the problem? We will take your calls and comments on that when we come back from a quick break. Stay with us. And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, a quick look ahead to tomorrow's program. My guest for the hour will be Maryland Attorney General Brian Frosch. We're going to talk about gun violence on Baltimore streets. We're going to talk about bail reform, the federal crackdown on immigration, the Trump travel ban, and Maryland's pushback on the Department of Justice's so-called election integrity investigation, plus lawsuits that the Attorney General of Maryland, along with the District of Columbia, have brought against President Trump himself, alleging that he's violating the Constitution's Emoluments Clause. So lots to chat about with Maryland Attorney General Brian Frosch. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, it's the Midday Health Watch with Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Nguyen. We check in with Dr. Nguyen about once a month, and you are welcome to join us. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle if you'd like to get us that way, @MiddayTomHall. So, Lena, what do you say to the folks who observe that there is perhaps a racial component to the reaction to this opioid epidemic, which is to say that when the cocaine epidemic was rampant and crack cocaine, now cocaine is not an opioid, it's a different class of drug, but still there are an awful lot of people addicted. And there are people in communities of color who are saying, you know, back when it was a black problem, because so much of the crack cocaine in terms of the law enforcement angle of that and the usage of it was happening in urban environments with people of color. There was no state of emergency called then. There was no reaction, from the governors and the president then. But now there is. How's that strike you?
I'd say that these people are right on the money. I was at a recent community event when somebody stood up and brought up this exact issue and said, I don't quite understand the state of emergency thing, because there's been a state of emergency around drugs my entire life. And I think we need to be honest with ourselves and say that when the addiction crisis, overdose crisis occurred in communities of color, in poor minority inner city communities, that somehow addiction was seen as a choice. And therefore, if somebody ended up in jail or they ended up dead, it was a moral failing on their part. And now that the disease or the epidemic has spread to white communities, to wealthy communities, to suburban rural areas, that it is now a disease. And it is a disease. I mean, the science has shown us that it is a disease. But I do think we need to be honest with ourselves and say that we owe generations of black and brown people an apology for what we have done, which is to incarcerate generations of people and to let them die, even when the science was there about what treatment was out there and what treatment is effective. So there is a racial component and a class component that we must be honest with ourselves about, even while celebrating that there are more resources available. And now the conversation has turned, because we are saying there is no face of addiction. That's true now. But we have to be honest with ourselves about the inequities that got us to where we are.
When it comes to prescription drugs that are fueling part of this crisis. Is there any downturn in the number of, you know, oxycodone pills and Percocets that are being prescribed now? Because certainly physicians have known about this for even longer than the general public. And there's been lots said about the fact that, you know, these opioids are often, these painkillers are often overprescribed. I mean, and there's also reports that say as many as two-thirds of the patients who get these drugs, oxycodone and that kind of stuff, don't use them. You know, they make the decision to, and disposing of them is a whole other issue, and disposing of them safely in a way that's good for the environment, that's a whole other deal. But is there any indication that physicians are prescribing fewer of them and monitoring it in a more close way?
So you're right that prescription painkillers and overuse of prescription painkillers are a major issue. 80% of those who use heroin first started by using prescription opioids. And we have something like 230 million prescriptions for opioids written every year, which is enough for every adult American to have their own bottle. Clearly a big issue. I see this anecdotally among my peers in the medical community that we are now paying attention. I mean, there is far more discussion in medical training, in medical practice than there ever has been. And the latest data from the CDC do show that for the first time in many years, there is a decline in the number of prescriptions for opioids written.
So at least that part of it is starting to, the trend is going the right way.
It's starting to, but you know, this is one of these issues that we all have to take responsibility. It is a problem for physicians, it's a problem by pharmaceutical companies, but I also believe that patients and consumers too have to play a role. I mean, we should not be going to the doctor and the first thing that we ask for is a pain pill.
Yeah.
If we have back pain, maybe we should be looking at other methods of treating pain and try yoga, try physical therapy. We should try to change our culture of expecting a pill for every ailment.
Mm-hmm. And you've talked about in your recommendations or your response to the White House Commission interim report, that physicians who are prescribing this stuff should also have a monitoring system in place and a drug treatment dimension to their practice so that they are keeping tabs on the patients that are taking these painkillers.
The stigma that affects the rest of the U.S. and the rest of our community doesn't make immune, or it's not that physicians are immune from that stigma either. Many physicians may still choose to not treat individuals who have the disease of addiction and who have mental illness. And my argument is, if we are able to prescribe opioids to get people addicted, then we physicians also have to have responsibility of treating people who have the disease of addiction too.
Let's go to the phones. Helen in Baltimore, welcome to the Health Watch with Dr. Lena Nguyen.
Hello. I wanted to talk about where the fentanyl is coming from. The committee under Governor Christie needs to start with honesty, because the fentanyl is coming from China, not Mexico. Mm-hmm. And they are using this as a part of the reason that they need to build this wall. They need to be honest, and Secretary Price, he needs to be honest too.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for that.
They are giving out the wrong information.
Okay, thanks for that call, Helen. And let me remind folks that when you call, make sure you turn your radio down so that we don't get an echo. But Dr. Nguyen, is the source of the fentanyl, as far as you know, is Helen correct? Is it mostly China as opposed to Mexico? And would our interdiction, obviously our interdiction approach would be different?
Our counterparts at the DEA and HIDA, which is the High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area, another federal entity that assists us with the law enforcement aspect, they tell us that fentanyl is being trafficked in from multiple other countries. China is certainly one of them. Mexico is named in there as well. That is what that is the best information that I can go by. Now, there is no doubt that we need multiple types of enforcement approaches in order to reduce supply. And again, this is both a supply and demand issue that we have to address.
Gregory, you're in Martinsburg, West Virginia, and you're on the line with Dr. Nguyen. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, you know, it ain't all about you.
That's right.
Yeah, so keep you there.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So, Gregory, I'm sorry. We're having trouble understanding anything you're saying. The line isn't so good. So why don't you do me a favor and hang up and call back, and we'll give you another shot if you're able to come back on a stronger line. It's just difficult to understand what's cooking there. One last thing about the funding for opioid mm-hmm. treatment. The numbers get thrown around left and right, and it's confusing to people. The administration is saying that they've doled out $485 million in 50 states. In April, they gave $70 million in grants for treatments. In May, they gave $80 million. Then when we had this conversation about the health care bill, one of the perks that Senator McConnell threw into the mix late in the game was an extra $45 billion for opioid treatment. That wasn't enough to get it over the line. The bill still failed. But all these numbers are lying around. I mean, what in terms of the city of Baltimore, for this fiscal year, which began July 1, will you have more, the same, or less money to work with for opioid treatment than you did in last fiscal year?
We will have more as a result of the 21st Century Cures Act that was passed during the Obama administration. Maryland has about $10 million more than we did before. There should also be funds available through the governor's state of emergency than we did before. The reason why those numbers are confusing, though, and I think this is an important point. During the talks about the ACA repeal and replacement, there were many conversations about how can we have more funding? How can we put a grant into or supply states with more grants to treat opioid, to treat the opioid epidemic? Now, I have no issue with the fact that there are grants and that we should have more grants in order to treat. The problem is we do not depend on grants for treating any other illness. If we're talking about heart disease or cancer, we would make sure that somebody actually got medical treatment for heart disease and cancer that's covered by their insurance. We cannot be dependent on grants to treat a medical illness, including addiction. And that's why it's so important for us to look at protecting Medicaid, where 1 in 3 of our patients in Maryland who are receiving addiction treatment are on Medicaid. You can't cut Medicaid and then give us a bunch of grants. That's not going to come close to covering the millions of people who would be affected this way.
So in this interplay and interconnection between the federal approach, the statewide approach, the city approach, is there a state in your estimation that's doing a really good job, a state that can be looked to as a model? I mean, many people have looked to you and your idea of prescribing naloxone to the body politic as a good approach. Are there people emulating that? And are there other things in other particular jurisdictions, not on the federal level, but particular jurisdictions that you look to as a good idea?
Sure. I'm proud in Baltimore City to be part of a health department that's been around for a long time and that has never taken a back seat. We've always taken aggressive, proactive approaches to public health crises, including being one of the first jurisdictions in the country to start needle exchange, and our aggressive approach for getting everybody the antidote to get Narcan into everyone's hands is something that is now being duplicated in multiple other places across the country. We do look to other places for other pilots that may be effective here. For example, Vermont has an excellent treatment approach, including with what they call a hub and spokes approach to treating people who have the disease of addiction. And we're looking into expanding such a model or piloting such a model here. And so there are multiple other things that we're trying to get from other places, although we all have one thing in common, which is all of us across the country, all my counterparts on the city, county, state levels across the country, recognize that we have an epidemic on hand and we need far more resources to address this epidemic in the same way that we would expect for any other illness.
Yeah, just to put a bow on this, you've made the point many times that what to do is not the problem.
That's
studies
right.
have been done. The data is there. You know what to do. It's just a matter of being able to affect that policy with enough resources. So let's change the subject to a grant that you got from the AARP, the Retirement Lobbying Organization, to help seniors, low-income seniors, have better access to food. This is, of course, another very difficult problem in a city like ours that has so many what we call food deserts, where it's just not convenient to get to a decent grocery store. So how's this going to work?
there is this rhetoric of choice that I want to address. And this is the case with opioids or health insurance, but certainly with food access too. You know, I have patients who come to me with heart disease, with diabetes, with high blood pressure, and I can tell my patients all I want that what they need to do is to eat better and to exercise. And then if they turn to me and says, but I have to take two buses and then walk 15 blocks in order to get healthy fruits, or the closest thing to a fruit that I can find in my grocery store is a shriveled up, or in my corner store is a shriveled up old banana, and I can find a bag of potato chips, and that's the closest thing I get to a vegetable. There's not really much choice that is there. And so recognizing that choice is really predicated on privilege. So 1 in 4 of our seniors here in Baltimore City live in a food desert. That's 19,000 seniors who lack access to healthy foods. And so they have to depend on family or friends for rides, or they just don't get these healthy fruits and vegetables at all. So we have had a program, two programs in the health department that we're very proud of. One is called Virtual Supermarket, and it allows for residents of 13 different buildings across the city to order groceries online and have them delivered right there to their ordering site. We also have another program to help that's called Healthy Corner Stores, and it helps corner stores to become healthy by helping them to buy and stock and supply fresh fruits and vegetables and other types of healthy produce. And so we're going to be able to add 40 more stores to our existing cohort of 17 of these healthy corner stores as a result of the grant that we got from the AARP Foundation and another grant from the Maryland Community Health Resources Commission as well.
These little corner stores might say, look, it's fine for us to have fresh apples and bananas and peaches and blueberries, but no one buys it. And so I, as the owner of the store, I go out and I purchase this stuff, and then it rots on the shelf, and I'm out the money. I mean, how do you change the market for that if in fact they don't have a history of selling things that are just better to eat?
You know, it's interesting. We started by talking to our community members about the issues that matter the most to them. And in the process of our conversations around designing our Healthy Baltimore 2020 approach, one of the main issues that came up from our community members is how much desire they had to have their corner store stock healthy fruits and vegetables. So we actually work backwards here. We find communities that express a strong interest in having healthy fruits and vegetables. We then identify a corner store that's interested in doing this, but may have questions about issues like refrigeration. Maybe they have concerns about who would purchase their supplies. Or maybe they don't want to start out by buying in bulk, but maybe they want to start out by buying a few items and seeing how that goes. That's what we assist them with. And we found that there is an excellent synergy here, that community members are seeking healthy options. And at the same time, many of our corner stores want to do the right thing. And so our approach is helping those who want to take that additional step. And we've gotten exceptional feedback so far from both the community and corner stores.
You're supplying the demand for them. You're saying, look, we've talked to the community, and if you stock this stuff, they'll come and buy it, right?
Exactly. And we partner with other groups like the No Boundaries program, who can help to then supply low-cost and high-quality produce to our corner stores.
Yes, they're very involved over in West Baltimore. All right, Dr. Lena Nguyen, she's the health commissioner of the city of Baltimore. We'll have more with Dr. Nguyen. We're going to talk about babies. That's something you know about as a doctor and as a mother who's an expectant mother who's maybe 2 or so weeks away from delivering her first child. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. Before we take a break, on Mondays here on Midday, we read the names of the people whose lives were lost to violence in the previous week. We stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. We get their names from Ellen Worthing, who has compiled a list of Baltimore homicide victims for the past 16 years. We also consult the Baltimore Sun's list of homicides, which they've been keeping since 2007. So far in 2017, 210 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. This past weekend, several organizers and many different groups held more than 40 events around the city as part of the Baltimore Ceasefire, an effort to curb violence from Friday to Sunday. There were four shootings during the ceasefire, two of which resulted in deaths, but there's no doubt that people from across Baltimore made their voices heard about ending violence and the root causes of poverty and economic inequality that often lead people to resort to violence. So we congratulate Erica Bridgeford, Ellen G., and the others who organized the Baltimore ceasefire. No one was killed in Baltimore on either Friday or Sunday. The two people who were killed on Saturday were Lamontre Tynes, he was 24 years old, and Dante Johnson, who was 37 years old. Last week, before the weekend, six people were the victims of homicide in the city. They were Dewan Hawkins, age 29, Wayne Damon, age 34, Degul Pietros, age 36, Melvin King, age 32, a 36-year-old man whom police have yet to identify, and Donta Cook. He was 24 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back. Back. It's the Midday Health Watch. I'm Tom Hall, along with Dr. Lena Nguyen, the Baltimore City Health Commissioner. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. If you want to follow us on Twitter, at Midday Tom Hall. If you want to send us an email, you can find us at midday@wypr.org. A couple more emails about the opioid crisis, Dr. Nguyen. Laura writes, the poor inner city residents have been in an epidemic for ages. The politicians called it an epidemic once whites in the suburbs started dying. That's a point that we made a little earlier in the program. Matt in Highlandtown says, I spent a lot of time in a lot of different parts of the city. I've never seen anyone overdose, and I know it's pretty much random as to who has Narcan. That's the antidote to the opioids, and whether you will ever be in the right place at the right time to need to use it. How is it decided as to who is armed with the drug, and is that an effective way of approaching it?
It's a great question, Matt, and my approach is that everyone should carry Narcan with them because we all have the ability to save a life. In the same way that there are defibrillators available in public places and we should all be able to use them, if somebody is dying in front of us, we should all be able to use Narcan. When we have a limited supply, though, we distribute to those who are the most at risk. And again, this is the definition of rationing here. When we have such a limited supply, we have to make very difficult decisions. So, for example, one of the groups that we distribute Narcan to first and foremost is individuals who are clients on our needle exchange vans. These are individuals actively using heroin, actively using IV drugs. They're also the most likely to be around others who are using drugs as well. Now, we're not condoning drug use, certainly not encouraging drug use, but we're saying if you are going to be using drugs, we want to help you to prevent spreading HIV hepatitis. We also want to enable you, empower you to save somebody else's life. We've found that for every 11 units of Narcan that we give out on our needle exchange vans, that one person's life is saved. We also make sure that our outreach workers who are on the front lines have Narcan as well. And many of the individuals who do home visits, who are out on the streets doing outreach every day, they have saved multiple people's lives because they are around the populations who are at highest risk. But again, there is no face of addiction. There's no face of overdose. And we encourage everyone to have this life-saving medication in their medicine cabinet and their first aid kit.
And police and EMT technicians, are they part of that, 5,000 doses, 10,000 doses, whatever it's going to be?
They are not. They have their own supplies. Paramedics and EMT certainly are all equipped to use Narcan. We've also been working with the police department and are making sure that the police, the front line, the patrol officers, at least in the areas that are the most vulnerable, what we'll be able to have Narcan with them. And they have had many saves also in the last 2 years since we started the program.
So let's move to the subject of pregnancy and infant mortality. And the infant mortality rate in Baltimore has been headed south. It's been making good progress now for a while. And there's a program that you've initiated in the health department, training people to be doulas during pregnancy and delivery. Tell us what a doula does and why you think this is a good way of approaching it.
Sure. Well, first I want to touch upon the Be More for Healthy Babies program, which is something that is one of our signature programs in the city. It's a collaboration between the health department and over 150 public and private partners, including the Family League, Healthcare Access Maryland, and supported by many of our wonderful partners, including by Care First. And as a result of this collaborative citywide approach, we have reduced the infant mortality citywide across the city by nearly 40% in the last 7 years, which is equivalent to 50 babies that would have died in 2009 that are now going to be alive today. And it's something that I think about a lot. I mean, what I want more than anything is to have a healthy baby. And I can't imagine the devastation of a family finding out about a child who died, especially from things that are preventable. So teaching the ABCs of safe sleep alone on the back in a crib, no exceptions, doing home visits, encouraging breastfeeding, getting free cribs to low-income mothers. I mean, these are all part of the Be More for Healthy Babies program that we're very proud of. We also constantly look at best practices and new practices that are being tried in other areas. And in New York City, for example, is trying to do a program around doulas. And so we started a pilot program to train 5 city residents to become doulas, who are non-medical companions who provide emotional support and comfort to women during delivery and after. And so doulas can help to play a guiding role during pregnancy. They can help to be the mom's and the family's advocate. And we're trying this to see if the doulas for our population here can further be an adjunct to help us to drive down infant mortality and support the mom and the family in this particularly trying time, too.
Yeah, how long does it take to train a doula?
There are a number of things that these women are going through. They go through a 3-day intensive training, and they also have to go through an accreditation process by the accrediting agency, Maternity Wise International. And so the certification process requires them to sit in on deliveries with other doulas, and so it takes a couple months or so for them to be up and going and to start the process themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very exciting time, but it's a very emotional time, and it's a physically challenging time. I mean, to have a baby, I mean, it is the miracle of birth is really quite something. But as a medical issue, I mean, there's just a lot that can go wrong, and to have somebody there in your corner during that, even when it all goes flawlessly, even when it goes perfectly, I would imagine it's a really good thing. Do you expect that this is something that you'll expand, that we'll have 10 doulas and 15 and 20 doulas in other iterations?
Well, this is something that we're piloting here, and we're also going to be looking at the program as it's being rolled out, not only here, but also in New York, Philadelphia, other places that are trying it. It's part of our overall comprehensive strategy, though, the Be More for Healthy Babies program. And I will say that, we're very glad to have all the gains made through programs like this. But we also, unfortunately, face a lot of threats to these programs, too. We just got notice a few weeks ago that the federal government is going to be cutting Baltimore City by about $3 million to terminate one of our programs for reproductive health education in middle schools and high schools. This is an evidence-based outcome-based with very successful outcomes for improving the health and well-being and to teach at-risk teens. And we're going to be terminating this program, which will affect about 20,000 of our residents in the city. So while we start these new pilots and they're exciting, we also have to remember the various threats that we're coming under with this federal administration.
On the flip side of infant mortality, is the mortality that we're experiencing among teenagers. Nationally, teen suicide rates is spiking to a 40-year high. I mean, there are more, particularly young girls, this is according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, more young girls in their teenage years are killing themselves than ever before. This was brought to light by this case in Massachusetts. A young woman named Michelle Carter was convicted in June of involuntary manslaughter for encouraging a friend of hers, a young man who also, like Ms. Carter, suffered from depression and had some mental health issues. She was encouraging him to kill himself via text message. They weren't even in the same city. And she was convicted of involuntary manslaughter and sentenced just last week to 15 months in prison. So where do things stand here in Baltimore in terms of teen suicide?
In Baltimore City, ever since 2005, we experience about 0 to 2 teen suicide deaths per year. We didn't see an increase during this period, but I do want to give you a number that really shocks me and disturbs me, which is that nearly 1 in 5 Baltimore City teens attempt suicide every year.
1 in 5.
1 in 5. So that's about 18.7% attempt suicide per year. And that is more than double what it is in the U.S., which is about 8.6% in the U.S., which is already horrifically high, 1 in 10 in the U.S. Now, there are many reasons for this. And I think one of the main reasons is that suicide, mental health issues are considered part of these unmentionables. That we're not talking to teens, we're not teaching teens about coping mechanisms, about developing resiliency, and parents may not, and caregivers may not be asking the questions in order to see if teens are needing help. I think it also we also have to talk about the trauma that so many of our teens here and teens across the country are experiencing, and it could be the trauma of bullying in school. It could be the trauma of experiencing violence in their own homes or seeing violence on the streets, but it could also be the trauma of racism. It could be the trauma of growing up in poverty. And these are things that we need to be much more mindful towards. And there's a lot more that we have to do to talk to our teens and build this level of resiliency that we in the city, just like all across the country, we need to do a much better job of this.
We have time to sneak in one quick phone call. Nancy in Lutherville, welcome to the Health Watch, the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Nguyen.
Hi, Dr. Nguyen. I so value your opinion, and I have a burning question. I'm getting ready. My daughter is getting ready to give birth in about 40-plus days. It will be her first child. It will be my 12th grandchild. Now, all of a sudden, there is this talk of where grandparents should get that Tdap. And I have...
That's a vaccine for whooping cough, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I understand, about 2 years ago, I was seeing a lot of it. The Big Bad Wolf commercial was every night, mm-hmm. but I don't see it anymore.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Nancy. So, I mean, do you recommend that grandparents get the PDAP vaccine for whooping cough?
So a few things. The first is that the vaccine is Tdap, which T, so it also includes tetanus as well. Mm-hmm. And actually that everyone should be getting the Tdap vaccine, including moms and grandmothers. Babies don't yet have immunity, and so it's important that we all follow the best guidelines, the most recent guidelines, including getting the Tdap vaccine, the flu vaccine, and others that protect ourselves and our loved ones.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Nguyen. I appreciate it. And congratulations to you and, you know, our best wishes to you and your husband, Sebastian, and that very lucky little boy that you're carrying around in your tummy these days.
So, thank you.
We will see you whenever we see you, because you're going to have a baby and be away for a little while. And then when you come back, bring pictures, okay?
I will do. Thank you.
Right, Dr. Lena Nguyen. She's the Baltimore City Health Commissioner. We check in with her every month here on the Midday Health Watch. Thanks to the Diz for supplying lunch today. They're located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends. They're on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. MarylandAttorney.com. Maryland Attorney General Brian Frosch will be my guest for the hour on Midday tomorrow. He's filed to join more than a half a dozen lawsuits against the Trump administration. We'll talk about those lawsuits and a host of other issues with Brian Frosch tomorrow right here on Midday. Stay tuned for Here and Now. That's coming right up after the NPR newscast at the top of the hour. For the entire Midday team, I'm Tom Hall. We appreciate your spending part of this rainy Monday with us. Stay dry and have a great day.